This is Embodied, our show tackling sex, relationships, and your health. I'm Anita Rao. When we start to talk about menstruation, a whole coded language emerges. A visit from Aunt Flo, riding the crimson wave, or it's just that time of the month. It can be so hard to talk openly and directly about periods, but it is so worth the effort because there is a lot going on that we could better understand, and each menstruating person experiences it a bit differently. I want to start this conversation at the intersection of science and culture with Kate Clancy, a biological anthropologist. Kate is an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's also the host of Period Podcast. Kate, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And you can all join our conversation on Twitter or Instagram. We are at EmbodiedWUNC. So we have a different relationship with our periods in each phase of our lives, and we're going to talk about this a lot throughout the show. But I want to start right at the very beginning. And we heard some wonderful stories from listeners and social media followers about their first period. So let's listen to what they told us.
I was a junior in high school, and as all the bad omens would have had it, I was in PE, and a boy happened to point it out to me.
When I started my period, I didn't realize that that happened. So I thought I was dying. I thought something was wrong with me. My mom had my dad tell me what was going on. He decided to use the metaphor of, like, I guess, horses, because I was very confused. He was like, and boys are like stallions. And I don't remember what he said girls are like, because I was like a stallion.
I grew up with a lot of women in my house. And as soon as my period started, like, I had everything. You know, I had the pads. I had, Advil on deck.
Puberty in general, but especially my first period, felt like this werewolf transition that was happening without my consent. And my second period that I ever got, I was in middle school, and I remember I had bled through this pair of jeans that I was wearing. It was so embarrassing.
My first period was just a non-issue. I knew exactly what to do. I just took care of it, and I went back outside to play. It was no big deal.
So those are some stories from our listeners and social followers about their first periods. I'm here with anthropologist Kate Clancy. And Kate, I know when I listen to that, so many memories and stories come flooding back to me about all of the trials and tribulations of being a menstruating person. But what resonates for you? What was your first period like?
Oh, my first period was my first month of eighth grade, about 2 months after I turned 13. And I remember just waking up, going to the bathroom, and there it was. And my mother just kind of peeking in with a little knowing smile, and my parents kind of being weirdly proud of me for the rest of the day.
Yeah, I remember running to the bottom of the stairs and just yelling up to get my mom's attention, like, "Mom, I think it happened," which, I mean, it's great to have a parent who can be supportive in that moment. Not everyone has that. But there's so much that we go into this moment kind of thinking about and expecting what a normal period is going to be like. And I know that you have thought a lot about this idea of normal. Tell me a bit about what we consider normal when it comes to menstruation.
So the thing that's tricky about that is that what we consider normal in a medical context is actually really constrained and a really small subset of all the really healthy ways to have a period and to menstruate. And so, you know, it actually, one of the things that I think it's really important for us to pay attention to is that context really matters, and that our bodies are very responsive to environmental stressors, like how much we are eating, how much we're moving around, whether we're, say, living in a global pandemic, and even the kinds of psychosocial stressors we're facing, not just from, say, facing a big test at school, but also when we experience things like sexual harassment and racial microaggressions, that these kinds of things tell our bodies that there are stressful things going on that maybe means we shouldn't be allocating as much to our menstrual cycles. And if that's the case, then it makes sense for us to experience variability during that time, because that's a flexible, adaptive, really smart response our bodies are making.
So there's so much going on that is in addition to bleeding. There's obviously hormonal surges and this full body experience that can happen. And I want to listen to a clip from someone named Jesse, who talked about this range of things that we experience when we have our period.
There's a whole range of things that happens during my period. You know, right before your period, you're bloated, you're miserable. Then whenever I actually start bleeding, I feel amazing. It's a time that I am very tender and gentle with myself. And so often we're just not very tender and very gentle with ourselves. But during my period, it reminds me to be appreciative of my body. I talk a little bit nicer to myself. I'm a little bit more understanding of myself. There's really a lot going on because it's not all cramps and miserable.
That was Jessie in Waynesville. And she really speaks to your point that our environment and the various changes in that at any given time can shape our experience of our periods. But I want to talk about hormones specifically, because I think this is kind of one of the biggest, misconceptions or source of mythology around periods, which is PMS and what PMS is and what's going on and how it affects folks who menstruate. So what is PMS scientifically?
Well, I think that, you know, to be honest, it's kind of hard to define scientifically because so many people seem to define it differently. I can tell you the premenstrual phase is the period of time between, about the peak of progesterone, if you happen to be ovulating, up to when you start menses. And that can be around a week long. Premenstrual syndrome, though, is really variably defined and can be experienced by anyone, anywhere from 20 to 80% of menstruators, depending on how you define it. And, you know, basically, it's a suite of negative traits that we have come to associate with the premenstrual phase. And if people express that they might sometimes experience some of those things and that they might happen to be during the premenstrual phase, then suddenly you have PMS. So irritability, tendency to cry, anger, bloating, you know, there's a number of both physical and psychosocial symptoms that we associated with it that do have a little bit of variability by culture as well.
So what's interesting is that there is a cultural difference, and you talk a lot about that in your research, kind of the need to balance our understanding of what is cultural and what is physiological and making space for the acknowledgement of both in a conversation about PMS in particular. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. I think, you know, what's tricky is that a lot of people try to define like the cause of PMS as being progesterone withdrawal, but progesterone withdrawal or just progesterone going down for the last week before menses is universally experienced by anyone who ovulates. And so what that sort of does is it broadens this definition of premenstrual syndrome to anyone who just happens to have a premenstrual phase, which is most menstruators, right? And so I think what we need to, you know, when I think about this intersection of culture and biology, I think we need to ask ourselves sometimes, one, how are we continuing to define and think about the external stressors that actually produce variation in the menstrual cycle? But also, how is it that the different types of confirmation bias we might not realize we are seeking might be influencing the way we think about things? So because we have these phrases like hormonal imbalance and being premenstrual, we have these ways of thinking that there must be a negative association here. So the confirmation bias happens both in the people who are practicing the science as well as people who are having these experiences within their bodies. And if we could actually start to disentangle some of those things, and there are people who do this, there are questionnaires that are about menstrual joy instead of menstrual distress. Mm. And there are studies that ask women to track symptoms without saying that it's a menstrual cycle study. And when you do things like that, when you ask people about joy, or when you ask people to track symptoms but don't say it's a menstrual cycle study, all of a sudden there's no premenstrual association with negative symptoms anymore.
And that's interesting too, because there are folks who do experience more severe symptoms, and that can actually lead to a diagnosis where they can get support around that, but it can fall under the umbrella of PMS. Right,
absolutely. Like, and it's important to pay attention to PMDD, right? Premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which is, a serious condition that affects a much smaller number of women or much smaller number of menstruators.
I want to play a quick clip now that kind of points to the fact that menstruation is a part of the experience of trans and non-binary folks as well. We talked to AJ Lowick, who's a trans health researcher, about what it is like for them to navigate menstrual health spaces. Let's listen.
So I come to this work as a trans person who menstruates and who struggles to navigate the gendered spaces that I need to access to kind of be in good menstrual health. I think some of the challenges stem from the very core of how we think about menstruation as a quintessentially and uniquely women's experience. And then that manifests itself into every single nuance of how menstrual health care is provided, from the decor of the waiting room of the OBGYN office to the availability of different bathrooms within that space, to how the medical provider talks to you and the language they use. I think for me, some of the most affirming experiences that I've had have been ones that nevertheless start with an apology. They start with an apology on the part of a healthcare provider who realizes that they're going to be giving me information that wasn't designed with me in mind. And then they overcome that by using the correct pronouns for me. But at the same time, they're still handing me a pamphlet or a resource or a document that has the word woman all over it. My hope is that in the future, the care will all around in every facet be affirming.
That was trans health researcher AJ Loick. My guest is Kate Clancy, an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We're going to take a quick break and we will return to this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Embodied from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is Embodied from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Let's face it, getting your period is not always convenient. You've got to make sure you're prepared with supplies, plan when you can slip out to the bathroom, and sometimes cancel your night out to chill on the couch with a heating pad. But for some people, menstruating causes much bigger challenges, like having to skip school or work because cost or transportation are barriers to accessing products. Here to talk with me about menstruation resources is Jasmine Shabazz. Jasmine is a member of the Youth Advisory Council and the board at Period, the Menstrual Movement. Hey, Jasmine, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Also still with us is Kate Clancy, a biological anthropologist and host of Period Podcast. And feel free to add your voice to the conversation today at EmbodyWUNC on Twitter and Instagram. So Jasmine, we ended the last segment with a clip from trans health researcher AJ Loick talking about the experience of navigating menstrual health spaces and how those spaces are not always inclusive. And we know that this can mean that there may not be products that people need in bathrooms that are divided by gender. So there are a whole range of ways in which menstrual access is unequal for a variety of folks. And that's something that you study in particular, kind of accessing the landscape and trying to learn more about menstrual equity, who has access to products and who has access to education about reproductive health. Tell me a bit more about some of the spaces that you spend time looking at where folks who need products are struggling to get access to them.
Yeah, so I concentrate a lot of my efforts going towards college institutions, whether that's undergraduate, graduate institutions, and making sure that students have access to products. And I believe that a lot of the conversation, again, goes around to stigmatization of periods, of course, but more so making sure that people have access to products and that that access isn't limited to cis women, because cis women aren't menstruators, like you just said. There's been instances of many colleges, you know, enacting period pantries or food pantries across the country. One in particular, Hampton University is actually starting a period pantry, which is spearheaded by Youth Advisory Council member and fellow board member of Period, Amber Nguyen, with the help of a Black-owned operated nonprofit called No More Secrets. And it's understanding that, you know, periods aren't limited to cis women. It's making sure that those who need access and can have access, and that products themselves are either affordable or free.
Well, yeah, the affordability question is huge because cost is definitely a barrier. We said a stat at the beginning that, you know, most folks in America who menstruate may spend, you know, $100 or more a year. And that is in part because there is a tax on period products. In North Carolina and 29 other states, there's a luxury tax on these products. We hear about it called the tampon tax. Tell me a bit about this tax and why it is, why it still exists.
Yeah, so I can actually use South Carolina as a case study just because I live here. This is where I organize at. So in 2016, there was a bill that was actually supposed to pass that would give cis women free menstrual necessities in state buildings, but however, it never passed. Last year, there was actually House Bill 4717, which is called the Female Health and Wellness Act, which, you know, I'll admit is a problematic title because it limits menstruation again to cis women. And it currently would eliminate taxes on menstrual necessities. This tax, the tampon tax in South Carolina, is a 6% tax. But the bill was actually recalled by the committee, and it was actually later reintroduced actually last week, and it's now titled House Bill 3747. And I believe that a lot of the conversation around the tampon tax is, of course, to, you know, eliminate a piece of the burden where it comes for low-income menstruators to be able to afford period products. And then, you know, of course, you have the opposite argument of, oh, but, you know, period products generate so much taxes for the state. In the state of South Carolina, that's $4 million. And it's trying to understand that menstrual necessities are a medical need. They shouldn't be taxed. They honestly, in my opinion, should be free and accessible to everyone who needs them.
Yeah, I mean, it brings up this idea of kind of what is an essential item. Menstrual products are considered non-essential items, which means that this tax is applied to them. And there's, I think, only one country maybe in the world where there are free period products. I feel like last year it was, I want to say it was Scotland. I'm not positive. Maybe you know the answer, Kate. But yeah, Kate, talk a bit more about this tampon tax and how it affects access to menstrual products.
Did you mean Jasmine or
no? Kate? You, Kate.
Well, sorry. I'm period. Menstrual equity is less my jam, but or less my area of expertise. But certainly, access is going to have all sorts of implications just for people's ability to access work and school. But also, you know, there are ways in which these. To use the term that Dr. Shara Vostrel uses, she's a really amazing feminist historian at Purdue. You know, these menstrual products allow us to have what we call what she calls technologies of passing. So ways that we can move through the world as menstruators, but without visibly menstruating. And that allows us to engage with a world that has a stigma against menstruation, as well as engage with a world that, you know, is going to be biased against people who are actively menstruating. And there's a really large research base that's super interesting, actually, about the ways in which menstrual stigma affects how close we want to be to people if we perceive them to be menstruating and how competent we think that they are at their jobs.
Well, yeah, I mean, you really do a deep dive into the cultural history of menstruation on your podcast. And there is an episode that I listened to that I found so fascinating, where you look at this idea that part of kind of the desire to kind of be really consistent in how we use menstrual products and the kinds of menstrual ways that we take care of our menstruation came from this push, women being pushed into the workplace, and the idea that if you show up consistently and you present consistently every day, that's going to be good for the business. And so there's this interesting link between menstruation and capitalism and this idea of a consistent presentation that really shows up when we look back at menstrual history.
And makes us, and also in a really interesting way, separates us from our bodies, right? I mean, it seems to be in some ways that's the other thing capitalism does, is makes us think that we are just, well, it depends on the type of work we're thinking about, but for a lot of white collar jobs in particular, we're kind of supposed to act like we are brains without needs of any kind all day long at work. I mean, especially if you consider what it's like to be operating in a pandemic right now, people are going from Zoom call to Zoom call and nobody creates like a 5-minute window to like use the bathroom, right? We just have back-to-back calls all day long where we have no chance to actually, you know, even if we weren't menstruating, just get a glass of water, use the restroom, have lunch, because people aren't building in this understanding that we are not, you know, we are not just brains. We have this whole sack of fluid that we have to take care of in order to stay healthy.
I want to listen to a clip from one more Instagram follower. This is Amanda talking about the cultural experience of menstruation.
I grew up in purity culture and I was like in it fully. So I truly believed my body should be as perfect as possible. And when you have blood coming out of you, you feel like your body is not as perfect as possible and is not this clean slate that it's supposed to be and that you're told over and over again. The consequence of growing up in that culture has been very, very evident on my just sexuality in general. So it's a constant battle to accept that it's okay to be a sexual being. It meant that my first sexual experience was me being very, very ashamed that I had done it. But that like all really started when my period started.
That was Amanda Jones in Raleigh, and I am here with two guests, biological anthropologist Kate Clancy and activist Jasmine Shabazz. Jasmine, tell me a bit about this idea of periods as unclean and how you have seen that play out in your own life or in conversations that you have through your work.
Yeah, so that goes, periods being unclean feeds into the stigma of periods and menstruation as a whole. And it's the idea that, you know, historically depicted as menstruators being cis women, that women themselves are unclean. That, you know, it's a way to make women feel less than, it's a way to make menstruators feel less than. And it feeds into the ideology of, you know, blood that comes out of a vagina is unclean. And that, you know, it's something that isn't a natural process and it shouldn't occur, but it is. It's a very natural process. Thousands, if not millions of people menstruate every day. So why shouldn't it be normalized?
And there's also, I mean, it's interesting to think about this idea of cultural context and how it can differ, Kate. I know you have done a little bit of research on various immigrant communities and various religious communities and how the experience of menstruating can look different for folks depending on those communities. I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, I think part of what we're talking about here is also the extent to which information is shared for towards folks as they're beginning their sort of menstruation journey. And among some religious communities, kind of to recall back to, you know, the story you shared from Amanda, right? Folks in purity culture, but also in other religious communities, they are told nothing about what menstruation is or what might be happening to them until it happens. And once they're menstruating, then they might, you know, and during which they're, of course, afraid that they're dying for many of them. Then they're kind of read in on, okay, now that you've had this experience, we can now inform you what this means and what you need to do. And, you know, some of the people I've spoken to over the years have said things like all they're really told is, hey, you can't hang around with boys anymore. Whereas others are really read into, for a lot of these, it's very gendered. So sort of read into the ways of being a woman, which for some cultures might be also, here's how you take care of a man. Here's how you take care of a house. But in others are actually about adopting, like learning the mythologies and stories of their home culture and getting read into adulthood in a way that's less about serving other people and more about carrying on the knowledge of their community.
Yeah, and kind of making that knowledge specific to you and your own family and your own context. I know I grew up in a Hindu family, and there are some kind of rules in Hinduism around what you can do as a menstruating person, whether or not you're supposed to be in the temple, whether or not you're supposed to be in spaces of prayer. But it's been interesting kind of within the context of my family to take those rules and talk about what they mean and how much we actually want to apply them to help us make sense of not putting more shame on our own bodies. So I think it can be a family-by-family experience. And that's something that one of our other listeners shared about, who is a menstrual equity activist, looking at period stigma in Black communities. Let's listen.
There is a stigma attached to having periods, specifically with Black women. We've always associated our self-worth with our personal appearance. And that comes from, like, internalized racism, where it was how clean we look, that was how approving we were in society. And period blood is not clean. It's not cute. It's not like something that we want to talk about. So erasing that stigma and just being really open, that's something that we're doing in the Black Period Project.
That's Lena Van, the founder of the Black Period Project. I'm here with biological anthropologist Kate Clancy and menstrual equity activist Jasmine Shabazz. Jasmine, I wonder if there's anything in Lena's clip that resonates for you about working within the Black community to erase menstrual stigma.
Yeah, I completely agree with her statements. And I feel like growing up as a Black woman in the South, there's even an even greater cultural stigmatization of periods and menstruation as a whole. When I got my first period at the age of 8 or 9, I honestly had no idea what a period was. I honestly thought that my leg was bleeding and, you know, something was wrong. Maybe I cut myself or something. And my mom sat me down and had a whole conversation about menstruation and periods and stuff like that. But I feel like growing up, you know, you're taught to, you know, hide your purse, hide your backpack. Don't let people know that you're menstruating, you know, because it fits into the idea of uncleanliness and that your body itself is being sexualized, and that, you know, people shouldn't know that you're able to get pregnant now. People shouldn't assume that you as a child, that that's something that you're thinking about. And it goes into the whole idea of sexualization of young Black girls as well.
Hmm. Yeah, and it gets so complicated, too, in terms of figuring out how to move through the stigma, how to combat it, because you want to be able to talk openly about something, but you want to do it in a way that doesn't perpetuate existing stereotypes and existing mythology. And I feel like that comes up a lot when we talk about menstruation in the workplace. And this is a question I have for you, Kate. I mean, when we think about kind of the need to talk more openly about menstruation and who's experiencing it, how do we do that in a way that doesn't play into narratives that have been used in the past to keep menstruating folks out of the workplace with the assumption that they're not fit for the job or they may be, you know, too emotional to get through that task that day?
You know, I think that's a really interesting and challenging question, and one that I think also, you know, this is a place where I don't feel like I have a lot of expertise to answer this well, but I would point to disability rights activists and many other communities who are, and activists who are encouraging us to reframe the way we think about work and the way that we think about what it means to show up fully at work. And that, you know, or even I'm even thinking of groups like the NAP Ministry, right? Like understanding that our bodies need rest is right now a very radical concept, and understanding again that we're not just brains that are devoid of bodies that, you know, don't always function perfectly all the time. It's a very radical thing to acknowledge that and create space for that right now. And I wish it wasn't so radical, because I think we all could use, and just like with many accessibility and inclusion and equity efforts, when we acknowledge that, you know, for instance, some bodies, like menstruating bodies, might sometimes need a break, what that actually does is that helps all bodies, whether or not they happen to be menstruating or ever will menstruate, because all bodies actually need breaks. So for me, I think it's, you know, how can we think about and bring in many different constituencies who are trying to think about, you know, this sort of workaholism that is so characteristic, certainly of American, but many other Western capitalist communities.
Completely. And the idea that if we were all able to think about our body's natural cycles through illness, through health, through various experiences we have monthly, it would be liberating for everyone. You wouldn't be expected to show up in exactly the same way and do the exact same amount of work every single day. And we would probably all have more compassion for one another. We heard from someone named Linda, who talks a bit about this experience of bleeding at work and this experience of keeping something silent that can impact how you show up. She had periods that were really long and heavy and extremely painful for a really long time, and it took her years to get diagnosed, first with endometriosis and then a bleeding disorder. But this was not something she brought up at all in the workplace, and ended up having a pretty big impact. So let's listen to Linda.
In my 40s, when I had decided to have a hysterectomy and I knew I was going to need to be out of work 4 to 6 weeks, I had told my supervisor so that they could schedule things around it. And one of my friends, who was also a supervisor, came up to me afterwards and she said, "Linda, you don't want to have a hysterectomy. You're too young." And I said, "Yes, I do." And she said, "Well, why?" And I said, "I've been battling endometriosis for 20 years. And she said, "But I thought that was painful." And I said, "It is. You just never noticed." I kept that private. The notion of having early hysterectomies is one that I have now heard about in terms of that should be a red flag for physicians that there might be a bleeding disorder. But my mother's was at the age of 37. She had one sister who had one at 35, another one at 38. And so the probability that there was bleeding disorder and or endometriosis in the family is high, but it also tended to mean that we thought we were normal.
That was Linda in Chapel Hill. I'm talking with biological anthropologist Kate Clancy and activist Jasmine Shabazz. I have about 30 to 45 seconds for this question, Kate, before we take a quick break. But what she mentioned in there, which is kind of the fact that some of these disorders get mislinked or misidentified by physicians because of some assumptions that we have about menstruation. Could you talk briefly about that?
Sure. And so the short version is just that, you know, even as we're trying to have this gender inclusive conversation about menstruation, people do still make this association that menstruation is still very gendered and that we typically only think of this around cisgender women. And so there is there's also this broader association and problem where we don't actually acknowledge the pain of women or consider it to be all that serious, or we believe that women must be lying about how much pain they're actually in. Like there's research showing that doctors take longer to prescribe pain relieving drugs to women. And in particular, this is especially true for women of color. And so just in general, if we have a whole medical context that doesn't typically believe women, then this is a way in which this is going to cause additional harm to menstruators of any gender.
All right. We are talking about periods today with Kate Clancy and Jasmine Shabazz, and we will continue our conversation just ahead and hear some more from listeners about their experiences, especially about how periods affect their relationships. Stay with us on Embodied. This is Embodied. I'm Anita Rao. We are talking today about menstruation. We will return to that conversation in just a moment. But first, I have an invitation for you to share your story for our show next week. We are going to be talking about polyamory, and we're curious to hear if you have been in a poly relationship, how have you communicated your needs to multiple partners? What have you learned about setting boundaries? Is there part of your experience you'd like to share? Please do so. Email us embodied@wunc.org or feel free to DM us on Instagram or Twitter. We are at embodiedwunc. Now back to our conversation about menstruation. I know for me, if there was a time that I had to look straight at the complicated stigma around menstruation, it was when I asked a partner to go into the grocery store to buy me tampons. Explaining what I need and the urgency of the situation can sometimes be awkward, even though I know that it shouldn't be. We had one listener who shared her experience with periods and relationships with us.
Yeah, navigating periods and relationships has been really interesting, particularly because I always have a heavy period. So if I'm spending any amount of time with people, then they know because I'm in the bathroom a lot or I'm changing clothes because I'm leaking. It's definitely something that I, you know, early in relationships, I have grown really comfortable talking about periods. And if you can't handle talking about periods or going and buying tampons for me if I need you to because I'm stuck in the car, then this isn't going to work.
I'm here with biological anthropologist Kate Clancy and menstrual equity activist Jasmine Shabazz. Jasmine, I'd love to hear your reflections on talking about menstruation in your relationships, whether with friends or with a romantic partner, what that experience has been like for you.
Since I've entered the period poverty phase and the menstrual equity phase, periods have, you know, almost always centered my conversations, and it began about a year and a half ago. I started to talk about periods more regularly in my conversations with friends, with people that I date, with, you know, my younger brother, and I feel like it's your individual job as a menstruator, in a sense, to help further the conversation of destigmatization about periods, and, you know, maybe that's coming with factual information, because a lot of people assume terrible things about periods that just simply aren't true. Maybe that, you know, making your period journey, your menstrual journey, more well-known, because not everyone has an easy period. Not everyone, you know, bleeds lightly. Some people have cramps. Some people have headaches. Some people, you know, vomit. Some people have more extreme cases of menstrual disorders. And it's making those conversations a normal part of your life.
Yeah, and it can be anything from like the very subtle to the more overt. I know I was having a conversation with my sister last week where we were talking about the experience in high school where you used to kind of tuck the tampon up the sleeve of your long sleeve shirt and walk to the bathroom that way, really trying to hide it to make sure no one noticed it. And like, why not just hold it out in your hand, whether you're at work or whether you're at school? Like, is that something that you've gotten more comfortable doing, Jasmine, I wonder?
Yeah, I feel no reason to hide any of my period products. Some people all around my undergraduate institution will tell you, you know, I've carried period products out in public, walking down the street, delivering them to our food pantry while I was in undergrad. And it's, you know, it needs to be normalized. It needs to be seen. It needs to be understood.
And I think this can start with kind of how we're talked about, how periods are talked to, how we are talked to about periods from being really young kids. We had one listener who shared how she communicates with her daughter about periods using technology. And I want to listen to that clip now.
We learned very early on that while my daughter was not into playing with dolls per se, the American Girl line of products has this amazing book series. That was a good resource for her to be able to process her own questions and then giving an open and safe space for her. And when she got her own smartphone, we found an app that we could both sync collectively so that I could see when she was on her period so that she didn't necessarily have to have conversations with me, because there is still the proverbial awkwardness between teenager and parent. But that way she could put all of her symptoms and all of her side effects of her period in there. And so if I had questions, I could just go to the app myself and say, oh, okay, well, she's experiencing this right now, so I need to give her space to feel that.
That was Callie in Durham. And Kate, I want to talk with you a bit about a couple of things in that clip. I know that you are a mother to a daughter who I don't think has gotten her period yet. But I'd love to know how you started communicating about it with your own daughter and how you're trying to set up that relationship.
Sure. It's been really fun, actually, because my daughter was fairly young when I started the period podcast. I mean, my first daughter, I have two. One of the things I always did was just really normalized menstruation. And, you know, my kids spend a lot of time in the bathroom with me. When you have kids, you don't always have a lot of privacy going to the restroom. So she saw me changing out pads, and I explained it quite often. In fact, my three-year-old also is very curious about pads and likes to open them up and play with them. And I talk about, you know, what goes onto them. So, you know, just that experience has certainly been normalized for a really long time for both of my children. But I think it was probably maybe age of 7 or 8 that I started telling my older daughter what it was, just anticipating that she or her friends might start having these experiences soon. And I will say, certainly there are a number of really great puberty books out there that I think introduce kids to this idea of menstruation. And I also really want to plug a graphic novel that I adore and have given almost every single one of my daughter's friends. It's called Go With the Flow by Lily Williams and Karen Schneeman, I think, Schneerman. And it's actually all about period equity, but it also really introduces folks to this idea that there is this menstrual stigma, and that there are people who maybe are less invested in the liberation of menstruators, and that, you know, this might be something that you need to think about or fight for, but that there's a good fight in there.
Yeah, and I like that also. I mean, Callie is talking about kind of experimenting with ways to start this conversation and continue this conversation, and she talks about apps and technology. And I'm curious, Jasmine, if you have any experience with these menstrual technology apps and how you feel about this way of kind of tracking your menstruation.
Yeah, so I actually use, I think it's called the Flow app, is what I use to track my menstrual cycle. And it's, you know, super convenient of making sure that I put in the days so I can know. And it's not just about menstruation, but knowing your whole menstrual cycle of when you're ovulating, when you're supposed to start bleeding, you know. And it fits into a larger conversation about how menstrual cycle is tied with sexuality and tied with, you know, pregnancy, and understanding when the days in your fertile window of when you can and can't get pregnant. And I feel like as a whole, these apps are more becoming much more popular and much more convenient for a lot of menstruators. And it brings up a whole completely different conversation, because with the Flow app, you have, you know, different sections of the app where you can not only track your menstrual cycle, but also ask questions to professionals in the field, whether that's physicians, whether that's menstrual leaders, and, you know, understand, is what you're experiencing in your menstrual cycle average? Is it normal? Is it abnormal? And making sure that you get help with that.
Well, there's so many different kinds of menstruation apps. And I know, Kate, you've looked into this a little bit, because there have been some big stories, kind of scary headline stories lately about data in menstrual apps and where that data is going and how it's being used. So I wonder kind of what your takeaway is around using these apps and how to make sure we're doing it in a way that keeps the information we want to keep private, if that's even possible.
Mm-hmm. I do think that you know, the ways in which some period apps are not particularly invested in data privacy is a major concern. And I think when anyone who would like to use a period app, you know, should really spend a little time doing research on the company that happens to be putting out the apps that they are considering. So there are certainly some companies for whom thinking about health and data privacy is a core part of their mission. And then when you look at their data privacy information, you can see that they're not going to be sharing your data with anybody. And then there's other folks who are creating these just as like a side project. And most of what they're doing is making, I don't know, Candy Crush lookalikes or something. And they actually are trying to take your data. That is the goal of having you download their period app. And so that's certainly one major issue. And there are some really great data scientists who are working about working on this and thinking about this. The other issue is that a lot of these apps have a tendency to be pretty heterosexist and assume that, and also assume that people care whether or not they are in a fertile window or a reproductive phase or not, which is certainly not the concern of everybody. A lot of them do not really do a lot to think about perimenopausal variability or menopause, which means that people in their 40s and 50s are going to have much more limited use for these apps. And most of the options, if you are looking at the pull-down menus for symptoms on a lot of these, they're all very negative. It's irritability, bloating, you know, the PMS symptoms that we were talking about earlier, as opposed to high libido and excitement and generosity and creativity, some of the other things that also vary through the cycle.
Yeah, that's so interesting, that intersection of the science and the culture and how the two kind of work back and forth to shape how we experience things. And I mean, it does seem like there has been a bit of an increase in focus around menstrual technology in the past few years with more apps, with an increase of things like period underwear. And I'm curious about that. I mean, is there more scientific research and resources being put into studying menstrual catching products in particular and their safety?
That I couldn't directly answer, but I can say that I think we need to ask ourselves whenever a corporation suddenly becomes very interested in something, the balance between how much money they are going to make off of menstruators' bodies, for in this case, versus, you know, the actual good that they're serving to menstruators. And so, I'm really glad that, for instance, there are companies, there's a growing number of companies thinking about reusable methods of catching period, right, of catching menstrual blood, like period underwear and menstrual cups and things like that. But what we know about their safety is actually a lot more limited than we might realize. And there are not a whole lot of large comprehensive studies to look at whether or not we are increasing risk of certain types of infections or other issues with sort of average use of these products. And we also don't always have a lot of insight, depending on the corporation, depending on the company, of what is actually in them. And so just a few years ago, Rose Eveleth wrote a really important piece where she tried to get to the bottom of what's in period underwear. And at least at the time of writing, Thinx would refuse to disclose what was in their period underwear, whereas Dear Kate's actually was willing to disclose. And there's a real concern that with those products, just as with disposable products, that we are being exposed to volatile organic compounds and phthalates. And these are both, certainly very harmful pollutants and ones that can be soaked up into the genital skin far faster than even on other parts of our body.
That's really interesting. So being able to kind of pay attention to the fine tuning and who's investing in what kind of science and what those results are, obviously really important for making sense of the new products on the market. I want to play one last clip now as we close out talking about families and intergenerational conversations and experiences of menstruation at different points in our life. This is a mother named Christina talking about approaching conversations with her kids. Let's listen.
My first period was just a non-issue. I knew exactly what to do. I just took care of it. And I went back outside to play. It was no big deal. But my baby sister, she had no idea. And by this time, I was in college and she called me freaking out and yelling at me because I hadn't warned her what was going to happen. So when I had my kids, I was like, hey, let's talk about this. So there are no surprises. One day around the time that they were 10, I was like, so one of these days you're going to get this thing called your period. And I put together to help them feel like it was something cool. I put together a little bag, like a little makeup bag, and it had like pads in it and a brand new pair of panties, and they just carry it around with them. So no matter where they were, it started, they were prepared.
That was Christina in Greensboro. I'm here with biological anthropologist Kate Clancy and menstrual equity activist Jasmine Shabazz. Jasmine, earlier in the program, you talked a bit about your experience not feeling totally prepared for your first period. But as an activist now and as someone who talks with folks all of the time, do you have advice for having these conversations more openly, whether you're a parent trying to talk with your child or maybe an educator in the school system, for folks wanting to make it a more open conversation?
I think that these conversations need to happen early, and they also need to happen for everyone. In the school systems, typically conversations surrounding menstrual cycles are typically directed towards cis women or, you know, cis young girls. And I feel like, you know, cis boys also need to have this conversation. And, you know, what if you have a trans boy in your classroom who doesn't want to be outed? You know, he also needs to have those, that understanding of what menstrual cycles are and what menstruation is, or, you know, a non-binary person. And it's making sure that everyone is receiving menstrual education, because it's important. You never know who might be a single parent raising someone who menstruates. And whether they are a menstruator or not, they need to also need to have the proper education of understanding what a menstrual cycle is, what occurs, you know, and also understanding the different menstrual disorders that go into it and when to seek help if help is needed.
Yeah, completely. Kate, we only have about 30 seconds left, but I know that you've spent time talking with some other parents and thinking about ways to have these conversations in ways that are inviting. Are there any tips or advice that you have for folks who don't know quite where to start?
I think the first thing is just normalizing it. If you are a parent who is a menstruator, I think just normalizing the purchasing of products when you need to, normalizing their use, and just exposing your kids to this just being just part of the daily lived experience of being a menstruator is being thoughtful about these things. I really feel like that's an important first step. And the more that you're raising awareness that this is a thing that will happen or could happen to you and or does happen to the people around you and the people you care about, the more you can create empathy and curiosity in your kids.
Kate Clancy is an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, also the host of Period Podcast. And Jasmine Shabazz is a member of the Youth Advisory Council on the board at Period, the Menstrual Movement. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find out more about our guests and everything we talked about today at our website, embodiedwunc.org. Also know that the conversation does not end here. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram. We are at embodiedwunc. Embodied is produced by Kaya Finlay and edited by Amanda Magnus. Elikam Dodor is our intern. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Al Wadarski also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.